Chapter 11. March 10th, 2:48 p.m. Nerchinsk, Russia. Tucker crouched beside Kane and carefully swung the hatch closed. The tunnel had exited beneath the shelter of a pine. Still, he swept fresh snow over the hatch to keep it hidden. Once satisfied, he wriggled his way out from beneath the boughs and into the open. Kane followed, shaking snow from his fur. "Ready for a little jog?" Tucker asked, acknowledging the press of time. He pointed east through the edges of a scrub forest. "Scout." Kane took off, bounding through the snow, bulldozing a path. Tucker trotted after him. They made relatively quick progress, covering 3/4 of a mile in an hour. He could have gone faster, but he did his best to stay below snowy ridgelines, out of direct sight of the town proper. Now was not the time to be spotted by a stray soldier. As they reached a stand of birches within a few hundred yards of the airbase, Tucker's watch vibrated on his wrist. He glanced down, seeing the countdown timer had gone off. Grimacing, he pictured the train pulling into the Chita station. How long until someone realizes I'm not on board? With no choice, he urged Kane onward and followed, pushing through his exhaustion, focusing on his next step through the deep snow. After another 10 minutes, they reached the edge of the airbase. The perimeter fence lay 50 meters ahead, topped by barbed wire. Suddenly, Kane stopped in his tracks, cocking his head. Then Tucker heard it too, a rhythmic clanging. He waited, then heard it again, recognizing it, a hammer striking steel. The sound came from ahead and to the left, not too far away. He pushed to a break in the trees where Kane had stopped. Beyond the fence stretched a single long runway, lined by 6 hangars and twice as many outbuildings, most of which seemed to be bolstered by a patchwork of sheet metal. The eastern side of the base lay a little farther to the right, out of direct view. Somewhere over there was the shack where he was supposed to rendezvous with Dmitri. But the loud clanging continued closer at hand, coming from the base. Curious, Tucker pulled out his binoculars, zoomed in on the buildings, and began panning. He searched for the source of the clanging and found it at the side door of a rusty hangar. "You've got to be kidding me," he muttered. Standing in the doorway was Fyodor. Under one arm, he clutched an aircraft propeller. In the opposite hand, an 8-pound steel mallet, which he slammed down on the propeller's leading edge. "Gong!" The sound echoed across the base to where Tucker was lying. "Gong! Gong! Gong!" He lowered the binoculars and squeezed the bridge of his nose between his index finger and thumb. It was too late now. For better or worse, he'd hitched his wagon to this Russian bear. He set out again, aiming right, searching ahead for the crumpled section of fence that marked the shack. At least from here, the terrain offered decent cover. The airbase had been abandoned long enough for the surrounding forest, once cut back for security purposes, to encroach upon the fence line. He kept to those trees, moving steadily, circling around to the eastern side of the base. Tucker had just stopped to catch his breath when he heard the thumping sound of helicopter rotors. Swearing, he pushed into the shadowy bower of a Siberian pine. He whistled for Kane to join him. As the shepherd rushed to his side, he craned his neck to the sky. The noise grew thunderous, making it difficult to discern the direction. Then, the dark belly of the Havoc streaked overhead at treetop level. The rotor wash stirred the powdery snow into a stinging whirlwind. Branches whipped overhead. Had they been spotted? What about their tracks through the snow? There was something especially unnerving about being hunted from the air. His every primitive instinct was to run, but he knew that path was the quickest way to get cut in half by the Havoc's chain gun. So he stayed hidden. The chopper moved past, slowly circling the airbase, seeming to follow the perimeter fence. He watched its slow passage, staying hidden, until he could no longer hear the rotors. Tucker waited another 10 minutes, just to be sure. he used the time to reassemble Felice's PSG-90. Once completed, he did a final check of the sniper rifle. Only then did he set out again, comforted by its weight. In less than 100 feet, he reached a corner of the airbase. He stopped and used his binoculars to survey the eastern perimeter. As Dmitri had promised, a section of fence had been flattened beneath a fallen tree. It lay about 300 meters away, and there stood the shack. The impulse was to hurry toward its relative safety, but he ignored it. Instead, he took a mental bearing and headed deeper into the trees, intending to circle wide and come at the shack from behind. He took his time, using the deepening shadows and snowdrifts as cover. Finally, the shack came into view again. It was small, 12 feet to his side, with a mossy roof and timber walls. He saw no light and smelled no wood smoke. Satisfied, he bent down and pulled up Kane's camera stock. He also made sure the radio receiver remained secure in the shepherd's left ear canal. Once done, he did a fast sound and video check with his phone. With the GRU unit on the hunt, he wasn't taking any chances, and he certainly wasn't going to enter that cabin blind. Tucker pointed at the shack, made a circling motion with his arm, and whispered, "Quiet, Scout." Kane slinks from his partner's side. He does not head directly for the cabin, but out into the woods, stalking wide. His paws find softer snow or open ground, moving silently. He stays to shadow, low, moving under bowers that burn with the reek of pine pitch. Through the smell, he still picks out the bitter droppings of birds. He scents the decaying carcass of a mouse under the snow, ripe and calling out. His ears tick in every direction, filling the world with the smallest sounds. Snow shushes from overburdened branches falling to the ground. Fir needles rattle like bones with every gust. Small creatures scrape through snow or whisper past on wings. As he moves, he sights the cabin, glances back to his partner, always tracking. He glides to the far side of the shack, where the shadows are darkest, knowing this is best for a first approach, where fewer eyes will see him. A command strikes his left ear, brash but welcoming. "Hold." He steps to the nearest cover, a fallen log musky with rot and mold. He drops to his belly, legs under him, muscles tense and hard, ready to ignite when needed. He lowers his chin until it brushes snow. His gaze remains fixed to the structure. He breathes in deeply, picking out each scent and testing it for danger. Old smoke, urine of man and beast, the resin of cut logs, the taint of thick moss on shingles. He awaits the next command, knowing his partner watches as intently as he does. It finally comes. "Move in. Close, Scout." He rises to his legs and paces to the cabin, scenting along the ground. His ears remain high, bristling for any warning. He comes to a window and rises up, balancing on his hind legs. He stares through the murky glass, deeply and long, swiveling his head to catch every corner. He spots no movement in the dark interior, so drops back to his paws. He turns to stare at where his partner is hidden among the trees and keeps motionless, signaling the lack of danger. It is understood. "Move out. Quiet, Scout," again. He swings away, angling around the corner. He checks each side, spies through another window, and sniffs intently at the closed door. He ends where he started.
"Good boy. Return."
He disobeys, instead dropping again to his belly by the rotten log. A low growl rumbles in his chest, barely heard with his own ears. A warning.
Tucker watched the video feed jostle as Kane lowered to his belly, his nose at the snow line. He heard the growl through the radio and noted the pointed stare of the shepherd toward the deeper forest to the right of the shack. He studied the video feed on his phone. Even with the camera, his eyesight was no match for Kane's. He squinted at the screen, trying to pick out what had seized Kane's attention. After 10 long seconds, he spotted movement 50 yards away. A lone figure hunched over, moved through the trees, heading toward the shack. Tucker swore silently and dropped quietly to his chest. He shifted the sniper rifle to his shoulder, flicking off the safety. The trespasser was also carrying a gun, an assault weapon from its shape and angles. The figure moved through thick shadows, hard to make out, camouflaged from head to toe in a woodland winter suit. He moved deftly, someone well familiar with hunting in a forest. Every cautious step cementing Tucker's certainty that this was one of the Spetsnaz soldiers, not a local hunter. Thank God for Kane's keen perception. But why only one? If there had been others, Kane would have alerted him. It made no sense. If the Spetsnaz knew he and Kane were here, they would have come in force. This had to be a lone scout. He remembered the Havoc helo circling the perimeter of the airbase. Apparently, the unit commander must have sent a man or two to do the same on foot. He raised the sniper rifle to his shoulder and peered through its scope, getting a sight picture. Once fixed, he sub-vocalized into the radio mic taped to his throat, passing on yet another command to his partner. Target. Quiet close. It was an order Kane knew all too well from their time together in Afghanistan. Get as close to the enemy as possible, and be ready. Kane began creeping toward the man. With his partner on the move, Tucker laid his cheek against the rifle's stock and peered through the scope. The target was 40 yards off, moving with practiced economy. He never paused in the open, only when behind a tree. His current line of approach would take him straight to Kane's position. 30 yards. Given the angle of the man's body, Tucker knew a headshot would be tricky. So, he adjusted the rifle's crosshairs and focused on a point a few inches below the man's left nipple. The soldier stepped behind a tree and paused, ever cautious. 2 seconds passed. The man emerged again from cover, ready to close in on the cabin. It was Tucker's best chance. He squeezed the trigger ever so slightly, took a breath, let it out, and fired. In the last millisecond, the soldier's arm shifted forward. The bullet tore through the man's elbow, shattering bone and cartilage, but veering wide from a kill shot. The man spun counterclockwise and disappeared behind the trunk of a spruce. "Takedown," he called out to Kane. He didn't want to track his partner. Instead, he dropped the sniper rifle and charged forward, drawing his P-22 pistol on the run. Ahead and to his left, Kane leaped through the air and disappeared behind the spruce. A scream burst out, followed by a spatter of automatic fire that shred needles from the tree. Tucker reached the spruce, grabbed a passing branch, and whipped himself around with his pistol raised. The soldier struggled on the ground on his back. Kane straddled him, his jaws clamped on his right wrist. The assault rifle lay nearby, but the soldier had a Makarov pistol gripped in his free hand. Time seemed to slow for Tucker. The man's gun hand turned, straining to bring the weapon to bear on Kane. Then the Makarov bucked. Kane was strobe-lit by orange muzzle flash, but unharmed. In his panic and pain, the man had shot too soon. Tucker refused to give him another chance. Stepping sideways, he took aim and fired once. The bullet drilled a neat hole in the soldier's right temple. His body went slack. "Release," Tucker rasped out. Kane obeyed and backed away a few steps. Tucker placed his boot on the Makarov, which lay half buried in the snow. There was no sense in checking the man's pulse. He was dead. His mind switched to their next worry. The gunfire would have carried through the trees. But how far? Who might have heard? Tucker took a moment to double-check Kane for injuries. Finding none, he gave the shepherd a quick neck ruffle, then pointed in the direction the man had come. "Quiet, scout." He had to know if reinforcements were on their way. As Kane moved off, he pocketed the Makarov, stripped off the man's camouflage suit, and stuffed it into his own pack. Though pressed for time, he spent a minute hand-shoveling snow over the corpse. The grave wouldn't stand close scrutiny, but it might buy him precious seconds. Finally, Tucker retrieved his rifle and moved deeper into the trees, where he found a tangle of fallen logs. If necessary, it would serve as a good sniper's roost. He checked Kane's camera, but all seemed quiet out there. Satisfied for the moment, he radioed to his partner. Return. 30 seconds later, Kane crouched next to him, panting. Good work, pal. Kane licked Tucker's cheek. Using the momentary lull, Tucker pulled on the camouflage suit. Now we wait. 4:39 p.m. After several long minutes, the snap of branches alerted Tucker. Someone was approaching from his 8 o'clock position. As he listened, the plod of footsteps grew louder, distinctly different from the soldier's cautious approach. Not Spetsnaz. A moment later, Dmitri appeared, lumbering through the forest. Still, Tucker stayed hidden, waiting, suspicion ringing through him. When Dmitri was 10 feet away, seemingly alone, Tucker called out to him. Stop! Dmitri jumped, genuinely startled. He lifted both arms, showing empty hands.
Is that you, my friend?
Tucker kept hidden. You're making a lot of noise.
Intentionally,
Dmitri replied with a half-smile.
I didn't feel like getting shot, da. I heard the gunfire.
We had a visitor, Tucker admitted, relaxing somewhat. Spetsnaz.
Is he...
dead. Dmitri, did you turn us in?
Niet, but you are smart to ask. I swear I have told no one about you.
And Fyodor?
The old man shook his head.
He has his flaws, but he has never betrayed me or a customer. Besides, you must trust someone or you'll never get out of here.
Tucker both believed him and knew he was right. Even Kane wagged his tail, wanting to greet Dmitri. He finally stood up, out of his blind. Dmitri joined him, eyeing his winter suit.
No clothes, I see.
Someone no longer needed them. Tucker pointed toward the airbase. Is Fyodor ready to fly? Matters are getting a little tense out here.
I think so. When I called him, he had just finished making some adjustments to the plane's propeller. Fine-tuning, he called it.
Tucker smiled, remembering the crude hammering. I saw. Together, they headed past the cabin and across the airbase. Dmitri took him along a circuitous path that mostly kept them hidden, working their way toward the hangar.
I am glad you are safe, Dmitri said. At the church, when I left you in that tunnel.
What exactly is that tunnel? Tucker interrupted, remembering the fresh boards shoring it up.
I found it by accident one morning. I felt a strange draft coming up from the floor and started prying up the boards.
And you've been maintaining it? He asked. The suspicion must have been plain in his voice. Dmitri smiled.
Myself and Fyodor. I told you he was a smuggler.
Tucker raised an eyebrow toward the town's old bishop, suddenly remembering how deferential everyone in the bar had been toward Dmitri. More than could be explained by religious affection.
Okay, perhaps Fyodor has a partner, Dmitri admitted. It is hard to maintain my flock on faith alone. But mind you, we don't smuggle anything dangerous, mostly medicine and food, especially during winter. Many children get sick, you understand.
Tucker could not find any fault in such an enterprise. It's a good thing you're doing. Dmitri spread his hands.
Out here, you do what you can for your neighbor. It is how we survive, how we make a community.
He pointed ahead.
There is Fyodor's hangar. I will check first. Make sure it's clear, da?
With Kane at his knee, Tucker waited while Dmitri went ahead. He returned 2 minutes later and gestured for them to follow.
All is good.
Dmitri led them through the main hangar doors, lit by a lone Klieg light. A single-engine prop plane filled the small space. Tucker couldn't make out the model, but like everything else at the airbase, the craft seemed a hodgepodge of bits and pieces. But at least the propeller was in place. He found Fyodor kneeling beside a red toolbox on the floor. Before they could reach him, Kane let out a low growl. The shepherd still stood by the door, staring out. Tucker hurried to the shepherd's side, careful not to show himself. He drew Kane back by his collar. Across the base, a pair of headlights passed through the main gate, turned, and headed in their direction. It was clearly a military vehicle. He drew his pistol and crossed to Fyodor. He raised the gun and aimed it at the man's forehead. "We've got visitors. No matter what else happens, you'll be the first one to go." Fyodor's eyes got huge, and he sputtered, first in Russian, then in English.
I tell no one! No one!"
He stood up, slowly, his palms toward Tucker.
"Come, come, follow. I show where to hide."
Tucker weighed his options as the grumble of a diesel engine grew louder. He remembered Dmitri's earlier words. "You must trust someone, or you'll never get out of here." With no choice but to heed that wisdom, Tucker pocketed his weapon.
"Show me."
Fyodor hurried toward the rear of the hangar, towing everyone with him. The big man led them to a giant orange storage tank, streaked with rust, that sat on a set of deflated rubber tires. A hose lay curled next to it. Tucker recognized an old fuel bowser used to fill the tanks of planes. Fyodor pointed to a ladder on one side.
"Up! Through hatch on top!"
Having already cast his dice, Tucker stepped to the ladder and crouched down. He turned to Kane and tapped his shoulder.
"Up!"
Backing a step, then leaping, Kane mounted Tucker's shoulder in a half-fireman carry. Together, they scaled the ladder and crawled across the bowser's roof to the hatch. Fyodor headed toward the hangar door, leaving behind a warning.
"Quiet! I come back!"
Hurrying, Tucker spun the hatch, tugged it open, and poked his head inside. The interior seemed dry. "At least I won't be standing hip-deep in gasoline." He pointed down, and Kane dove through the hatch, landing quietly. Tucker followed, not as deftly, having to struggle to pull the hatch closed, too. His boots hit the bottom of the empty tank with a clang. He cringed, going still, but the rumbling arrival of the military vehicle covered the noise. In complete darkness, Tucker drew his gun, his nose and eyes already stinging from fuel residue. But he also smelled bananas, which made no sense. He shifted to a better vantage, but his foot hit something that sounded wooden. What the hell? He freed his tiny pen light and flicked it on. Panning the narrow beam, he discovered the back half of the Bowser's tank was stacked with crates and boxes, some marked in Cyrillic, others in various languages. He spotted one box bearing a large red cross. Medical supplies. On top of it rested a thick bunch of bananas. Here was more of Dmitri and Fyodor's smuggling operation. It seemed he was now part of the cargo. From outside, he heard muffled Russian voices moving around the hangar. Then they approached closer. He clicked off his penlight and gripped the pistol with both hands. It sounded like an argument was underway. He recognized Fyodor's tone, which sounded heated, as if in the thick of a furious negotiation. Then the conversation moved away again and became indiscernible. After another 10 minutes, an engine started, rumbling loudly, wheels squelched on wet tarmac, and the sounds quickly receded. Seconds later, feet clomped up the ladder, and the hatch opened. Tucker pointed his pistol up. Fyodor scolded.
"No shoot, please! Safe now!"
Tucker called out.
"Dmitri!"
"They are all gone, my friend."
Fyodor groaned.
Da! As I say, safe!"
Tucker climbed up, poked his head out, and looked around. Once confident the hangar was clear, he dropped back down, collected Kane, and climbed out.
price higher now,
Fyodor announced.
Dmitri explained.
They were looking for you, but mostly they learned about our operations here. Not unusual. Every village in Siberia has such a black market system, so people talk. The soldiers came mostly to collect what could be most kindly described as a tax.
He understood. The roving soldiers weren't above a little extortion.
Cost me best case of vodka,
Fyodor said, placing a fist over his heart, deeply wounded.
We told them that we were about to leave on a postal run, Dmitri explained. If they're collecting the tax, there should be no problem getting through. Even soldiers know the mail must flow, or their vodka here might dry up.
Tucker understood. Neither snow nor rain nor dark of night. Fyodor looked quizzically at him.
Is that poem? You write it?
Never mind. How much more do I owe you? Fyodor gave it much thought.
2,000 rubles. You pay, da?
I'll pay. Fyodor clapped his hands together.
Happy! Time to go. Put dog in plane. Then you push plane out, I steer. Hurry! Hurry!
Tucker rushed to comply. Not exactly first-class service, but he wasn't complaining. Part 2. Hunter Killer. Chapter 12. March 11th, 11:15 a.m. Novosibirsk, Siberia.
And how confident are you of Dmitri and Fyodor?
Ruth Harper asked. Tucker stood at a payphone next to an open-air fish market. The pungent smell of sturgeon, perch, and smelt hung heavily in the cold air. He had spent the previous 10 minutes bringing Harper up to speed. He was surprised how happy he was to hear that southern lilt to her voice. If not Tennessee, then maybe...
Do you trust those Russians?
She pressed.
I wouldn't be making this call if either of them had ratted me out. Plus, I've been strolling the snowy streets of Novosibirsk for the past 2 hours. I'm clean, and it's still another 1,200 miles to Perm. If I pick up a tail, I'll have plenty of time to shake it loose.
Still, you're cutting the rendezvous close.
Bukalov will keep. If they, whoever they are, had any idea where he was, they wouldn't be after me.
Which reminds me, any further word about the source of that leak?
No luck yet, but the story you just told me, one involving GRU and Spetsnaz, we know the enemy has powerful connections in either the Russian government or military. I'm looking hard at the Ministry of Defense, or maybe someone at a cabinet level of the government.
Maybe you'd better be looking at both.
A scary proposition. Do you want help out there?
Tucker considered it for a moment. For now, no. We've got enough players in the field. Makes it confusing enough. Plus, he liked working alone. Well, not quite alone. He gave Kane, seated at his knee, a reassuring pat.
If I change my mind, Harper, I'll let you know.
Do that. As it happens, I've got nobody to give you right now.
Busy on the home front?
Always. World's a dangerous place. At least Sigma can offer you some logistical support. Do you have a wish list for me?
Tucker did. After reciting the provisions he needed, he signed off. He would find all he asked for once he reached the city of Perm, secured and cached in a safe house. But first, he had to get there. Harper had arranged clean papers and seemed confident that Russian immigration and customs did not have him on any watch list, making it safe for him to fly. Furthermore, Sigma's intelligence team had arranged another level of countermeasures, booking false tickets, hotel rooms, and car rentals. He was everywhere and nowhere. Still, whether it was his inherent wariness of all things governmental or simply a tactical change of mind, Tucker called a local car rental agency after hanging up with Harper and booked an SUV for a one-way trip to Omskaya, some 400 miles to the west. He had no reason to distrust Sigma, But there was no mistaking the reality of his current situation. He and Kane were out here alone, without any hope of reinforcements. Harper had tasked him with getting Abram Bukalov safely out of Russia and to the United States. How exactly he accomplished that was his decision, and he preferred it that way. With Kane on a leash, he walked the mile to the rental car office and picked up the vehicle, a Range Rover of questionable age, but the engine purred and the heater worked. Tucker took it and left Novosibirsk at midday, heading west down the highway to Omskaya. 3 hours later, he pulled off the highway and drove 6 miles north to his true destination, Kuibyshev. It never hurt to employ his own countermeasures. Following the pictograph signs, he pulled into the local airport. Using a map and a smattering of Russian, he booked a flight to Perm. 16 hours after he left Novosibirsk, his flight touched down at Perm's Bolshoye Savino Airport. He waited in cargo claim for Kane to emerge from the belly of the plane, then another hour for immigration to clear them both. Minutes later, he and Kane were in another rental vehicle, this one a Volvo, and headed into the city proper. From the car, he called Sigma for an update.
"Still no blips on immigration or customs," Harper informed him. "If they're still actively hunting you, they're not doing it that way."
"Or they're giving me enough time to get to Bukalov before snapping shut the trap."
"Is this safe house I'm heading to manned?" he asked, intending to collect the provisions he had requested without delay.
"It won't be. It's an apartment. Call the number I gave you, let it ring 3 times, then again 2 times, then wait 10 minutes. The door will be unlocked. 5 minutes inside, no more."
"Are you kidding me?"
"Simplicity works, Tucker, and this is a lot simpler than meeting someone on a park bench with a flower in your lapel and your shoelace untied."
Tucker realized this made sense. In fact, one of the acronyms soldiers lived by was KISS. Keep it simple, stupid.
"Fair enough," Tucker said, but he gave voice to another troubling matter. "It's South Carolina, isn't it?"
"Pardon?"
"Your accent."
She sighed heavily, giving him his answer. "Wrong."
"Tucker, the details for your meeting tonight will also be in the safe house."
"And my contact?"
"His name and description are included in the dossier you'll find there. He's hard to miss."
"I'll call you after it's done."
"Keep out of trouble," she said.
"Are you talking about both of us, or just Kane?"
"Kane would be much harder to replace."
Tucker glanced to his partner.
"Can't argue with that," he said, and signed off.
Now came the hard part, grabbing Abram Bukalov without getting caught. Chapter 13. March 12th, 8:55 a.m. Perm, Russia. His visit to the safe house was thankfully anticlimactic. He left with 4 new passports, 2 for him and 2 for Bukalov, along with a roll of cash, a pair of credit cards, a 2nd satellite phone, and the location of his meeting with Sigma's contact, the one who was supposed to lead Tucker to Bukalov. This mysterious contact was also high in his list of suspects as the source of the intelligence leak that almost got him killed. The man's dossier rested on the seat next to him. He planned on studying it in great detail. Next, Tucker took advantage of a list of local suppliers left at the safe house. He traveled to a bakery whose basement doubled as an armory. The baker asked no questions, but simply waited for Tucker to make his weapon selections from a floor-to-ceiling pegboard. He then wrote down the price on a piece of paper, which he handed to Tucker with a gravelly, "No negotiate." The next supplier, the owner of a car lot, was equally taciturn and effective. Through Harper, Tucker had pre-ordered a black Marussia F2 SUV. Of Russian manufacture, it had a front end that only a mother could love, but it was a brute of a vehicle,
often modified for use by first responders or as a mobile command center. After paying, Tucker told the owner where to leave the vehicle and when. With 6 hours still to spare before he was supposed to meet with his contact, Tucker proceeded to the neighborhood in question, the Leninsky District on the northern side of the Kama River. Once there, he parked the Volvo and began walking. In between scouting locations and routes, he was able to relax and take in the sights. Straddling the banks of the Kama and within the shadow of the snow-topped Ural Mountains, Perm was home to a million people. While the city had its share of Soviet gray architecture, the older Leninsky district continued to maintain its original European charm. It was a cozy neighborhood of tree-lined streets and secluded garden courtyards, spattered with small cafes, butchers, and bakeries. To top it off, the sun shone in a cloudless blue sky, a rare sight of late. As he strolled, no one seemed to pay much attention to him, just a man walking his dog. He wasn't alone in that regard. Much of Perm was taking advantage of the handsome day. Kane took particular interest in a pair of leashed dachshunds that passed by on the sidewalk, all three dogs doing the customary greeting of sniffing and tail wagging. Tucker didn't mind, as attached to the other end of the leash was a buxom young beauty in a tight sweater. The day certainly had brightened. Eventually, as they crossed the half-mile-long bridge spanning the Kama, he abruptly found himself in a different world. On this side of the river, it was distinctly seedier and less populated. The area was mostly forest, with roads that were either dirt or deeply potholed. The few inhabitants he encountered stared at the pair as though they were alien invaders. Luckily, where he was supposed to meet his mysterious contact was only a quarter mile from the river. He studied it from a distance, getting the lay of the land. It was a bus stop shelter across from a sullen cluster of businesses, a grocery store, a strip club, and a body shop. Tucker finished his reconnoiter, then gladly crossed back over the bridge. He and Kane returned to the Volvo, found a nondescript hotel in the area, checked in, and took a fast nap. Tucker knew that once he had Bukalov in hand, he might not get a chance to sleep again until he delivered the man across the border. That is, if he ever reached the border. In the end, he didn't sleep well at all. 8:12 p.m. By nightfall, Tucker found himself parked in an elementary school lot on the wrong side of the tracks, or in this case, the wrong side of the river. The school had boarded up windows with a playground full of rusty, broken equipment that looked perfect for spreading tetanus. He had picked this spot because it lay within 100 yards of the bus stop where he was supposed to meet his contact. He shut off the engine and doused the lights, and sat in the darkness for 5 minutes. He saw no other cars, and no one moving about. Again, no one seemed to be following him. This made him feel more uneasy, not less. It was what you couldn't see that usually got you killed. He turned to Kane, motioning with a flat palm, "Stay." He had debated the wisdom of leaving Kane behind, but if the meeting went awry, he wanted to make sure he had an escape vehicle. And considering the neighborhood, Kane's presence in the Volvo was better than any car alarm. He often wrestled with this exact quandary. With the memory of Abel's death never far, he had to fight the temptation to keep Kane out of harm's way. But the shepherd loved Tucker, loved to work, and he hated to be separated for long. They were a pack of two. Even now, Kane displayed his displeasure at Tucker's order, cocking his head quizzically and furrowing his brow. "I know," he replied. "Just mind the fort." He took a moment to check his equipment. A Smith & Wesson 44 caliber snub nose in his belt, a hammerless Magnum revolver in his coat pocket, and a similar 38 caliber model in a calf holster. Additionally, he kept a pair of quick loaders for each in his pockets, This was as close to armed to the teeth as he could manage. Satisfied, he got out, locked the car, and started walking. He hopped a chest-high fence and crossed the school's playground to the north side. He followed a line of thick Russian larch trees, bare and skeletal, around a vacant lot that was dominated by mounds of garbage. On the other side, 50 yards away, stood the bus stop. The curbside shelter was little more than a lean-to over a graffiti-scarred bench. Across the street, under the strip club's neon sign, a silhouette of a naked lady, 4 thugs lounged, laughing, smoking, and chugging bottles of beer. Their heads were shaved, and they all wore jeans tucked into black steel-toed boots. Staying out of their sight line, Tucker checked his watch. He still had 20 minutes. Now came the waiting. Back at the hotel, he had read the dossier on his contact, a man named Stanimir Utkin. He was Bukalov's former student and now chief lab assistant. Tucker had memorized his face, not that it took much effort. The man stood 6.5 feet tall, but weighed only 150 pounds. Topped by a shock of fiery red hair, such a scarecrow would be hard to miss in a crowd. Right on time, a cab pulled to a stop before the bus shelter. The door opened and out climbed Stanimir Utkin. "Come on," Tucker mumbled. "Don't do this to me." Not only had Utkin arrived by cab to the exact spot of their meeting, displaying a reckless lack of caution, he had come wearing what appeared to be an expensive business suit. His red hair glowed in the pool cast by the street lamp like a beacon. The cab pulled away and sped off. The driver was no fool. Like sharks smelling chum, the 4 thugs across the street took immediate notice of Utkin. They pointed fingers and laughed, but Tucker knew this phase wouldn't last long. Utkin was too tempting of a target, either for a mugging or a beating, or more likely both. Tucker jammed his hands into his pockets and tightened 1 fist around the Magnum. Taking a deep breath, he started walking fast across the open lot, keeping out of sight as he headed toward the back of the bench. He covered the distance to the bus shelter in 30 seconds, by which time Utkin had begun glancing left and right like a rat who had spotted a snake. One of the thugs threw a bottle across the street. It shattered on the curb near Utkin's toes. The skinny man stumbled backward, falling to his seat on the bus bench. Oh, dear God. 10 feet behind the shelter, Tucker stopped in the shadows and called out, keeping his voice low enough so only Utkin could hear him. According to the dossier, the man spoke fluent English. "Utkin, don't turn around. I'm here to meet you." Another beer bottle sailed across the street and shattered in the street. Harsh laughter followed. "My name is Tucker. Listen carefully. Don't think. Just turn around and walk toward me, then keep going. Do it now." Utkin stood, stepped out from under the shelter, and headed into the abandoned lot. One of the thugs called out, and the group started across the street, likely drawn as much out of boredom as larceny. Utkin drew even with Tucker, who hid behind a stack of tires and trash. He waved him on. "Keep going. I'll catch up." Utkin obeyed, glancing frequently over his shoulder. By now, the thugs had reached the bus stop and entered the lot. Tucker stood up, drawing out his Magnum. He took 3 paces into the light, showing himself. He raised the pistol and drew a bead on the lead thug's chest. The group came to a fast stop. Tucker summoned one of the Russian phrases he'd been practicing. "Go away, or I will kill you." He raised the Magnum, a mean-looking weapon. His Russian language skills might be lacking, but some communication was universal. Still, the leader looked ready to test him, until they locked gazes. Whatever he saw in Tucker's eyes made him change his mind. The leader waved the others off, and they wisely retreated. Tucker turned and hurried after Utkin,
who had stopped at the fence that bordered the schoolyard. He was bent double, his hands on his knees, hyperventilating. Tucker didn't slow. He couldn't trust the thugs wouldn't rally up more guys' additional firepower and come after them. He grabbed Utkin's arm, pulled him upright, and shoved him toward a neighboring gate.
Walk!
Coaxed and guided by Tucker, they reached the car quickly. He opened the front passenger door and herded Utkin inside. The man balked when he spotted Kane in the back. The shepherd leaned over the seat to sniff at the stranger. Tucker placed a palm atop Utkin's head and pushed him inside. Still panicked, the man balled up in the passenger seat, twisted to the side, his eyes never leaving Kane. Not the most auspicious introduction, but the man had left him little choice. Tucker started the engine and drove off. Only once back over the bridge and in more genial surroundings did Tucker relax. He found a well-lit parking lot beside a skating rink and pulled in. "The dog won't hurt you," Tucker told Utkin.
"Does he know that?"
Tucker sighed and turned to face Utkin fully. "What were you thinking?"
"What?"
"The taxi, the business suit, the bad part of town."
"What should I have done differently?"
"All of it," Tucker replied. In truth, Tucker was partly to blame. From the dossier, he had known Utkin was a lab geek. He knew the meeting site was dicey. He should have changed it. Utkin struggled to compose himself and did a surprisingly admirable job, considering the circumstances.
"I believe I owe you my life. Thank you. I was very frightened."
Tucker shrugged. "Nothing wrong with being frightened. That just means you're smart, not stupid. So, before we get into any more trouble, let's go see Bukalov. Where is your boss?"
Utkin checked his watch. "He should still be at the opera."
"The opera?" Utkin glanced up, seemingly not bothered that someone seeking to escape the country, someone being hunted by Russian elite forces, should choose such a public outing. Tucker shook his head. "You remember when I said, don't be stupid?" Over the next few minutes, he got the story out of Utkin. It seemed, faced with the possibility of never seeing the motherland again, Abram Bukalov had decided to indulge his greatest passion. Opera.
"They were doing one of Abram's favorites," Utkin explained.
"Faust. It's quite..."
"I'm sure it is. Does he have a cell phone?"
"Yes, but he will have turned it off."
Tucker sighed. "Where is the opera house, and when does it end?"
"In about an hour. It's being held at the Tchaikovsky house. It's less than a mile from here."
"Great. Just great." He put the Volvo in gear. "Show me." 10:04 p.m. 10 minutes before the opera ended, Tucker found a parking spot a few blocks from the Tchaikovsky house. As angry as he was at Bukalov for choosing to preface his defection by dressing up in a tuxedo and attending a public extravaganza, the deed was done. Still, this stunt told him something. Bukalov was either unstable, stupid, or arrogant, any of which did not bode well for the remainder of their journey. Tucker left Kane in the car and accompanied Utkin down the street. He stopped across from the opera's brightly lit main entrance and pointed toward its massively white stone facade. "I'll wait here," he said. "You go fetch the good doctor and walk to the car. Don't hurry, and don't look at me. I'll meet you at the Volvo. Got it?"
"I understand."
"Go." Utkin crossed the street and headed toward the main entrance. As he waited, Tucker studied the crimson banner draped down the front of the theater. The fiery sign depicted a demonic figure in flames, appropriate for Faust, an opera about a scholar who makes a pact with the devil. I hope that's not the case here. A few minutes later, Utkin emerged with Abram Bukalov in tow. The billionaire leader of Russia's burgeoning pharmaceutical industry stood a foot shorter and 40 pounds heavier than his lab assistant. He was bald, except for a monk's fringe of salt-and-pepper hair. Following Tucker's instructions, Utkin escorted the man back to the car. Tucker gave them a slight lead, then followed. Once he was sure no one was tailing them, he joined them at the car.
"Hello!"
Bukalov called, offering his hand. Irritated, Tucker skipped the formal introductions. Instead, he used the remote to unlock the doors.
Utkin in front, Bukalov in.
"Dr. Bukalov,"
the man corrected him.
"Whatever. Doctor, you're in the back."
Tucker opened the driver's door and started to climb in. Behind him, Bukalov stopped and stared inside.
"There's a dog back here."
"Really?"
Tucker said, his voice steeped in sarcasm.
"How did he get back there?"
"I'm not sitting next to..."
"Get in, or he'll drag you inside by your tuxedo lapels, doctor."
Bukalov clamped his mouth shut, his face going red. It was doubtful many people had ever spoken to him like that. Still, he got in.
2 blocks later, the pharmaceutical magnate found his voice.
"The opera was tremendous, Stanimir, though I doubt you would have appreciated the subtleties. Say, you, driver, what's your name? Is this your dog? He keeps staring at me."
Tucker gave Utkin a narrow-eyed glance. Who got the message?
"Dr. Bukalov, why don't we talk about the opera later? We can..."
The man cut him off by tapping on Tucker's shoulder.
"Driver, how long until we reach Kazan?"
Resisting the urge to break his fingers, Tucker pulled to the nearest curb and put the Volvo in park. He turned in his seat and faced Bukalov.
"Kazan, what are you talking about?"
"Kazan, it is the oblast of..."
"I know where it is, doctor."
The city of Kazan lay about 400 miles to the west.
"Why do you think we're going there?"
"Good God, man, didn't anyone tell you? This is unacceptable. I am not leaving the country without Anya. We must go to Kazan and collect her."
"Of course we do."
"Who's Anya?" he asked.
"My daughter.
I will not leave Russia without her."
11:22 p.m. Sticking to his original plan, Tucker headed out of town, stopping only long enough to trade the Volvo for the new Marussia F2 SUV. They found the brute of a vehicle parked where he had instructed it to be left, on the south end of town. It was fully gassed and carried a false license plate. Reaching the P-242, he continued west for an hour, doing his best to tune out Bukalov's rambling monologue, which ranged from the mysterious Anya to the industrial history of the region, to Kane's disturbingly intelligent mien. On the outskirts of the small town of Kungur, Tucker pulled into the hotel parking lot and decided he'd put enough distance from Perm to regroup. He got out and called Harper and brought her up to speed.
"This is the first I've heard of this Anya," Harper said.
"You described the doctor as eccentric.
You were being generous."
"He may be a bit..."
She paused to consider her words.
"Out of touch, but there's no mistaking his brilliance. Or his desire to leave Russia. And to answer your unspoken question, we're convinced he's on the up and up."
"If you say so."
"Where is he now?"
"In the back seat of my SUV. Having a staring contest with Kane. I had to get some air.
Listen, Harper, if Anya is the bride piece to get Bukalov out of the country, that's fine. But let's make sure she's real before I head to Kazan. That's a good 7-hour drive from here."
"Agreed. Give me her full name."
"Hang on." Tucker opened his door. "Doctor, what is Anya's last name?"
"Bukalov, of course. She's my daughter. What kind of question?"
Tucker straightened and spoke to Harper.
"You heard?"
"I did."
The professor added,
"She works at the Kazan Institute of Biochemistry and Biophysics. She's quite brilliant, you know."
Tucker slammed the door, muffling Bukalov's ramblings.
On the phone, Harper said,
I'm on it.
Bukalov rolled down the window a few inches.
Apologies. How forgetful of me. Anya took her mother's surname, Malinov. Anya Malinov.
Harper heard that too.
Got it. Name's Malinov. What's your plan, Tucker?
In the short term, to check into a motel. It's almost midnight here. Tucker waited until Bukalov had re-rolled up his window. He took a few additional steps away before broaching a touchier matter. Harper, what about Utkin? The lab tech continued to remain on the short list of potential leaks. But were such breaches accidental or done on purpose? Tucker trusted his gut, along with his ability to read people. He found nothing that struck a wrong nerve with the young man, beyond simple naivete. It seemed Harper had come to the same conclusion.
Our intelligence can find nothing untoward about Utkin. He seems as honest as they come.
The maybe was a slip of the tongue. Something said to the wrong person, by Utkin, or maybe even by Bukalov. That guy seems a few fries short of a happy meal.
I keep looking into it. In the meantime, I'll dig into this Anya business overnight and get back to you by morning.
With the call done, he led everyone to the hotel for the night, booking a single room with two beds. Tucker parked Kane at the door, knowing the shepherd would keep guard for the night. He half-dozed in a chair, while Bukalov puttered around the room, muttering and complaining before eventually unwinding. Around 1 a.m, he sat down on the edge of the bed. Utkin was already asleep in the other.
I'm sorry, Bukalov said. I've forgotten your name.
Tucker. He nodded to his partner. That's Kane.
I must say, your dog seems well-mannered enough. Thank you for coming to get me.
You're welcome.
Did they tell you about my discovery?
Before he could answer, Bukalov shook his head dismissively.
No, of course not. Even I didn't tell them, so how could they know?
Tell me about it. Bukalov wagged a finger.
In good time, but I will say this. It is monumental. It will change the world of medicine, among other things. That's why they're after me.
The Arzamas generals.
Yes.
Who are they?
Specifically? I don't know. They're too crafty for that.
Tucker stared across, sizing the other up. Was this guy suffering from a paranoid delusion? A persecution complex? Tucker fingered the healing bullet graze in his neck. That certainly was real enough.
Then tell me about Anya, he said.
Ah!
Bukalov's face softened, holding back a ghost of a smile.
She's wonderful. She means everything to me. We've been working in tandem, the two of us. At the distance, of course, and in secret.
I thought Stanimir was your chief assistant.
Him? Ha! He's adequate, I suppose, but he doesn't have the mind for it. Not for what I'm doing. Few people do, really. That's why I must do this myself.
With that, Bukalov kicked off his shoes, sprawled back on the bed, and closed his eyes. Tucker shook his head and settled into the chair for the night.
Bukalov whispered, his eyes still shut. I'm not crazy, you know.
If you say so.
Just so you know.
Tucker crossed his arms, beginning to realize how little he actually knew about any of this.
March 13th, 6:15 a.m., Kungur, Russia.
Despite the discomfort of the chair, Tucker slept for a solid 5 hours. He woke to find both of his charges still sleeping. Taking advantage of the quiet moment, he took Kane out for a walk, let the dog stretch his legs and relieve himself. While they were still outside, Harper called.
Anya's real, she said as introduction.
I don't know if that's good news or bad.
If Anya were a figment of the good doctor's imagination, they could get out of Dodge immediately. Harper continued.
We were able to confirm there's an Anya Malinov working at the Kazan Institute of Biochemistry and Biophysics, but not much else. A good portion of her file is redacted. Kazan's not as bad as the old Soviet-era Naukagrads, their closed science cities, but large swaths of the place do fall under the jurisdiction of the Ministry of Defense.
So not only do we need to go to Kazan, but I have to extract this woman out from under the military's nose?
Is that a problem?
I'll have to make it work. Not like I have a whole lot of choice. You asked me to get him out of Russia, and that's what I intend to do. Him and now his daughter, apparently. Which presents a problem. I've only got new passports for Bukalov, not for Anya. And what about Utkin, for that matter? He wouldn't survive a day after we're gone. I won't leave him behind.
He flashed to Abel, panting, tongue lolling, tail wagging. He wasn't about to abandon another teammate behind enemy lines. Harper was silent for a few seconds. Even from halfway around the world, Tucker imagined he could hear the gears in the woman's head turning, recalibrating to accommodate the change in the situation.
Okay. Like you, I'll make it happen. When do you plan to go for Anya?
Within 24 hours. More than that, and we're pushing our luck.
That won't work. I can't get new passports for Anya and Utkin over to you that fast. But if you gave me your route from there...
I don't know it yet. Considering all that's happened, it's hard to plan more than a step in advance. All I know for sure is the next step. Free Anya.
Then hold on for a minute.
The line went silent, then she was back.
After you fetch Anya, can you get to Volgograd, as the crow flies at 600 miles south of Kazan?
Tucker pulled a laminated map from his back pocket and studied it for a few seconds.
The distance is manageable.
Good. If you can get to Volgograd, I can get you all out. No problem.
Out sounded good. So did no problem. But after all that had happened, he had no faith about the outcome of either proposition.